Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Perry Nicholson. Perry is a chiropractic physician with a focus on chronic pain. He has become well known for his work on blood and lymphatic flow and the importance this has on healing and recovery. Perry, also known as the Lymph Doc, has been running Stop Chasing Pain for over 15 years and was one of the first health podcasts ever, beginning in 2010. His focus is broad, extending to nutrition, performance enhancement, corrective exercise, and facilitating self-care. Perry's workshops on lymphatic flow, breathing, gut function, and his popular Big Six technique have gained significant popularity and are accessible to everyone. For those interested, I've linked Perry's workshops, podcast, and Instagram below if you'd like to learn more about his approach to teaching you how to improve your own lymphatic flow. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share information that goes well beyond the scope of this podcast. I also share a solo podcast expanding on this conversation if you'd like to get even more insights into these topics. Becoming a subscriber is the best way to support my work and this podcast. With all that being said, I hope you enjoy the conversation. All right, Perry, it's great to have you on. I've been wanting to talk to you for a really long time. You know, I remember listening to your podcast back in like 2017 when I was first getting interested in health, and you were one of the first podcasts I ever listened to. I remember you talking to Jerry Pollack and my mind just being blown, you know, back in the day. So it's great to have you on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Yeah, that's going way back. I forget sometimes how long I've had that podcast on. I think it's almost close to 12 to 15 years I've had my own show. It's crazy.
Yeah, you were well ahead of the curve, and very, very appreciative that there was someone out there who was putting information like this out for free, which was very helpful for people like myself. And, you know, you've been a chiropractor for basically as long as I've been alive, which means you've got a lot of experience, and this is what makes me so interested in the work that you're doing. So maybe, you know, I'd just love to get a bit of a background on how you got interested in sort of, I guess chiropractic is sort of like energy medicine in a sense, and looking at health in a more broad sense.
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, so I've been a chiropractor close to 30 years now. Goes by really fast. So that was my entryway into healthcare. And of course, since then, I've studied a lot of other different types of disciplines and approaches, but that was the fundamental one. And I think I got into chiropractic like many people get into physical therapy or acupuncture or medicine. One, I think you really want to help other people. But two, you experience something yourself. You had some type of injury that particular profession helped. So usually somebody says, man, I really want to go to PT because going to physical therapy, that's what PT is, really helped me. And then same thing with even medical doctors. Chiropractic did that for me. Mine was a really severe lower back disc herniation injuries several times where I could really barely move and stand. I mean, many people listening to this can relate. I think most humans can, because back pain is one of the top things that people still experience. And I went to a chiropractor, and within a couple of visits, I felt so much better. And I said, wow, this is really amazing. I wonder if I could do this. And then he was very encouraging and said, sure, you can if you want to. And that was it. And then so that was my initial entryway into healthcare.
From your point of view, I'd love to know, what is the goal of chiropractic? I think it's something that's quite misunderstood in the public sphere. People just think it's cracking, you know, every year you just cracking stuff. But from a philosophical point of view, what are you trying to achieve with chiropractic as a profession?
Yeah, great question. Well, I mean, we use cracking, mobilizations, manipulations, adjustments. There's a lot of different words that you can use for it. And they have stuff like that in osteopathic medicine. They have that in physical therapy as well, where you're just trying to get movement in joints of the body, not just the spine. I mean, that's kind of where you start, because your spinal cord lives there, and the nerves that come off your spinal cord that go to all the body parts that somebody's trying to get to function better or to heal, So they want to go to the source of the nerve supply, which, I mean, that makes physiological, anatomical sense, right? But chiropractors and other professionals, they can move other joints too. Like if you need a movement in an ankle joint, for instance, wrist, elbow, shoulder. I mean, if two bones come together, chiropractors and osteopaths can pretty much get more motion in them. But listen, I've been doing this a long time, and here's what I've learned. Every single healthcare discipline is trying to accomplish the same thing, helping people not suffer so much and heal from chronic pain and inflammation and live a better quality life. They're just using different words and verbiage to describe what they're doing, but we're all influencing the same physiological structures. It just depends on what's your paradigm that you're going after, right? So chiropractors are really great at helping when you have musculoskeletal pain, but they're also finding that when you can help, the spine move better and function better, the nerves can move better and function better, and therefore everything that those nerves supply, perhaps they'll function better. But it's a two-way street. It's not just the spine going to the body part. It's the body part going to the spine and then to the brain. So in actuality, you're actually affecting the brain significantly when you do anything to any part of the body, because you'll see through your own experience and study that pain in and of itself is not in the tissues, it's in the brain. So if you can do anything to influence the brain to change pain, that's a good thing. And chiropractic is just one way to accomplish that.
I see, you know, in the modern day, most people have some sort of structural imbalance. And I speak from experience, you know. And I'm curious, with your experience, what do you think are the primary reasons or ways in which people become imbalanced structurally as they grow up, particularly throughout childhood when their bodies are more plastic?
Yeah, I love that question. And this is something that I tell people all the time. Just because you have an imbalance doesn't mean something's wrong. You're not supposed to be perfectly balanced. That's impossible. There's always an asymmetry in the body from one side to the other side. One is because of a neural dominance from one side of the body to the other side of the body. Like a right-handed person is going to have a different structural development than a left-handed person. But you know, I've seen people that actually look mangled in the structural part, and they don't feel any discomfort, any pain. Life is great. And then I've got some people that look textbook perfect and they can't get out of bed. So I want people to realize that there's no clinical correlation between something being structurally, and I don't even like to use the word dysfunctional, like there's just compensations and adaptations that are taking place. And some of it's through no fault of your own because you're born that way.
Right.
Some people will develop an issue and other people will not develop an issue. So you have areas of the body that may be more prone to you experiencing physiological symptoms when something happens to that particular area. Pardon me. For instance, what I mean by that is that let's say you don't have good motion or mobility in the ankle joint, which it doesn't move that well. Over time, that may translate up to somebody who has more issues, you know, in the foot itself. The knee will usually pay a big price for anything in the ankle, but it can travel up, and that's a person who can experience pain in the lower back or pain in the neck or the jaw. And that's where this stuff can be so overwhelming, and that's what stop chasing pain means. Is that somebody may have like something that looks structurally imbalanced or not right, and then they feel pain there. But that doesn't mean that that's the cause of the pain just because you feel it there. I've been doing this 30 years. I can tell you that's rarely the case. I mean, X marking the spot is like a unicorn. Sometimes you get lucky and maybe you'll find one, especially when it's chronic. So if you've had pain that's not gone away in an area or areas after 3 months, it's never just the site of pain that you have it in. So we look at structure, right? And you know, you have structure and you have form and you have function, but you can strive for perfect whatever you think mobility should be. That doesn't mean that you're going to be free from experiencing chronic pain or issues that hit you. Like, that was a big eye-opening thing for me, is that I see people who have had MRIs and studies, and they have severe imbalance, osteoarthritis in the spine, and multiple disc herniations. And then it's news to them. I don't feel anything. Can I go run? Sure, go ahead. And then I got somebody who looks perfect, textbook, and they got 8 out of 10 pain.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there have been large-scale studies done on this with functional MRI, looking at chronic pain.
When you get into chronic pain, you'll find your way getting into the brain and the central nervous system and neuroplasticity and neurology a lot. And they've determined that there's not going to be an absolute 100% correlation between something showing physical damage and experiencing pain. But that's a slippery slope, because what happens is that if you see physical damage, then sometimes just seeing it makes it hurt. Because you've been programmed by somebody or medicine that if that's messed up and looks like that, that's the reason that you're in pain. And that's not the case. So there's a lot of people that have disc herniations, for instance, and they get surgeries that don't help, because for that person, clinically, it wasn't the cause.
Right.
And then they chase after that with everything, because that's got to be it, man. I mean, look at the size of that thing. No, it doesn't. Yeah. It can come from somewhere else, and it very often does. And that's the tricky part, because the area that it comes from, you don't feel pain in it. So one, you probably won't even look there because it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
But when you understand pain and you understand how the body is one piece, it's not parts, and especially when it's chronic, you know you have to look somewhere else for the answer. And it's usually in a place that you would never expect. So after 30 years, I look at everything.
This speaks so well to the idea of tensegrity and how you cannot reduce the body down to constituent parts at all. And, you know, the fact that, you know, you've discovered throughout your career that it's very rarely at the site of pain, chronic pain, where the problem is stemming from, and where the problem is likely where it's being compensated for the most. It's just such a brilliant example of how the body works as a whole, rather than, you know, you have a back and you have an ankle and you have an elbow. You cannot affect one part of the body without impacting the entire body as a whole. And I think this speaks to that idea perfectly. And I wanted to ask you about breathing mechanics and its role, particularly in stabilizing the lower back as well. I used to work as a pulmonary scientist and work with a lot of people who have breathing difficulties. And I used to see some of the most disordered breathing you could imagine. And I think I heard you say quite some time ago that when you breathe, the act of the muscles of the diaphragm coming down almost massage the kidneys as they're going up and down. And throughout the course of a lifetime, the kidneys will make the equivalent of a journey to the moon and back because of the massaging from the diaphragm. And it just makes you realize how important breathing is to structure. And I'm curious to hear your views on how breathing can affect chronic pain and the structure of the body as well.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Thank you. Yeah, I can imagine the different types of things you've seen in your experience with pulmonology. In my world, by the time you come to visit my office, you've had things for a long time. You're very chronic. You've had a lot of tests, had a lot of different therapies, a lot of treatments. So I automatically know there will be some type of maladaptive breathing that somebody's got going on, which means in my world, they're probably breathing just too much from the neck and the mouth and the chest and the shoulders and all the stuff in the upper body, which that breathing pattern feeds a nervous system response of fight or flight and survival. So you kind of get yourself stuck in quicksand and then you stay there based on the breathing. And you have a tendency to breathe that way when something hurts too, because you just want it to go away.
Yeah.
Right. The most optimal breathing that I search for in people is that, can they do anything from underneath the rib cage? Like the, that's called the thoracic diaphragm. Okay. So the first thing I look for is, where is the person taking their breath from? I could see it right away, and usually the body will show you signs of it too. So the single biggest reason I look at breathing is it changes pressure throughout the body. So diaphragm is a pressure system, and pressure changes force and stress on every square inch of the body. I'm a big person who does a lot with fluid dynamics in the body, biofluids. So I have to look a lot at human blood flow and lymphatic flow and cerebrospinal fluid flow in particular in relationship to pain. And breathing will affect all of that. So if your breathing patterns are off, you will have a fluid flow problem throughout the body, and then that will lead to pain and inflammation and stuff like that, which we can get into later when we talk about the lymphatics. But I really discovered the breathing and its role in helping the lower back and the organs by studying osteopathic medicine visceral manipulation, which is just manipulation. It's just like if I took a spine and I manipulated it and I moved it, like a chiropractic treatment or osteopathic treatment, you can do the same thing to the organs. You get in there and you're trying to push the organs and move the organs to give them mobility, because they're supposed to be mobile too, like joints. And also the motility, which is the movement itself in the organ itself. And why would you have to do that? Well, because they get stuck too from tightness or tension, and they're wrapped in this bubble wrap fascia connective tissue like everything else. So when people talk about fascia, they get so caught up in the fascia of the musculoskeletal system, they forget the visceral system underneath. And fascia is all interconnected. So if you have something with a deep fascial connection in an organ, that can refer pain to a musculoskeletal body part like the back or the shoulder or things like that. And that's actually what's called the viscerosomatic reflex. Viscero for visceral, somatic, soma, body, where, wow, my back hurts and I think it's my back, and that's the person who has cancer. Right. So cancer in an organ, and then boom, your back hurts.
Right.
Classic case. But, you know, why would you have to move them? Because they're stuck. Why would they get stuck? Because people don't have the most optimal breathing pattern anymore of using that diaphragm, because it should move the organs a lot. Like if You can go on YouTube. I can't remember the video of it, but just type in keyword, maybe breathing and organs. And sometimes you can see just how much movement is supposed to, that's the word, supposed to happen when you breathe. And you're like, wow, that's a lot of stuff happening in there. And at the bottom, you have what's called your pelvic diaphragm or your pelvic floor. That's the hammock underneath that's supposed to catch the organs so they don't end up on the floor. So it's this big, giant piston cylinder like this. So the organs move because it keeps the blood flow and the lymph flow and the poop moving and the food moving and all the gastric juices and all that stuff. So it flows. So that doesn't get stagnated. So I'll be honest with you. Yeah. I mean, breathing is super important. So you get this thing called oxygen, which you need that. And improper breathing will mess up the ratio of oxygen to carbon dioxide in the body, which will feed an inflammatory environment. So if your breathing is not optimal, you're going to suffer at some point in time. But the movement of the organs is a huge one. Like the kidneys, especially, because what's fascinating, man, is the kidneys sit right on top of the psoas muscle. And the psoas muscle is a muscle that everybody always has an issue with, and they're trying to stretch or get in there and release, and it causes a lot of low back. But that can happen too if the kidney doesn't move well and gets stuck in its fascia connection, because this should actually slide along the psoas like on a rail, like a train, like this, back and forth with every breath.
Right.
And if it gets stuck like that and gets some increased tension, and then what happens is you get what's known as a muscle guarding reflex. So whenever there's excess tension or any underlying inflammation around an area, the muscles are programmed to tighten and guard for one reason and one reason only: protection. So I can't tell you how many times I've seen it where people feel so much better in the lower back when you teach them how to breathe from the diaphragm, because the organs will start to move. You'll optimize the pressure down here, which will take so much tension off the lower back.
That's such a fascinating way to look at it. And you mentioned the gut basically, and the movement through the GI. I've worked with people who, particularly women who suffer with severe constipation, sometimes, not going for up to a week, maybe more at a time between visits. And I would love to know a little bit about your perspective on treating not just constipation, but also diarrhea, and how the movement of the body actually plays into how the gut moves and gut motility and how the gut works as well.
Yeah, fascinating question. So, in my approach, when I'm looking at any area of the body that needs help in some way, whether it's too much of something or not enough of something, right? For instance, too much pooping, diarrhea, not enough, constipation. I look at three things. One is the nervous system and the nerve supply to whatever areas of the body may be having an issue. Okay. Because that's the only thing that tells those areas what to do, or those areas feed signals back into the spine and the brain to try to tell them what it needs. So something is off. So the first thing I look at is nerve supply. Okay, I'm going to walk you through my clinical reasoning process. So when you have the gut, you have a parasympathetic supply and influence to the gut. And many people are familiar with that. Some might not be, of the vagus nerve and the influence of the vagus nerve on digestion. Okay. And the vagus nerve, if you're not familiar with that, is a cranial nerve, which means it comes off the brain stem right here at the brain and what's called your medulla. You have a left one and you have a right one. It travels down to the gut, and the gut travels up the vagus nerve both ways. So if you have an issue with that nerve, you can have some disturbance down below in what the gut ends up doing for digestion and for pooping. That's why many people who've had a head trauma or a concussion or neck issues have gut issues, because it's not the gut that's the problem, it's the relay from the brain and the neck down. You follow? So you have that aspect. Then you also have a sympathetic side. And that's, to me, I'll be honest with you, that's the more important side. Because that's the side that controls the vascular flow of the gut. And the sympathetic nerve supply to the gut comes from the spine, the thoracic spine. So the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, should balance with each other. You don't want too much of one, not enough of the other. You don't want it to get stuck in sympathetic, and you don't want it to get stuck in parasympathetic. They should be on a playground with a seesaw where we go up and we go down and everybody's happy. That's called balance. That's called homeostasis. But many people get stuck. So this is where I would go and then look at what's happening with the thoracic spine, because you may have an issue there where that's the reason that your gut's a problem, because it's coming from the thoracic spine. Too much sympathetic input. All right. You can also have, with the gut in front, massive lymphatic stagnation in the abdominal region, which you likely do, because most of your lymphatic system actually resides in your gut. So if you have stagnation in the gut of the lymph flow, and you have poor blood flow in the gut because of too much sympathetic, they call that hypervigilance, hyperarousal, fight or flight, just stress in life. Then over time, what that's going to do is that's going to mess up the ability for, it's called transport time. How fast food travels through this gut system from your mouth to the poop chute. So it can be really quick or it can be too slow. So for me, I always look at those three things first: nerve supply and blood flow and lymph flow, which are the fluid flow. And then here's where the nerve comes into play, because the nervous system is the one that will control the vascular flow. But you can also have just so much tension and stuff in the abdomen because of that poor breathing that we mentioned before, that you've got stagnation in fluid because there's not enough movement in the area because of the breathing. And then that stagnation can irritate the spine. So what I'm telling you is the spine can cause the gut issue, and the gut issue can cause the spine issue. It can go both ways. They can get caught in this loop. And what I want people to know is there's way more to helping somebody with constipation or diarrhea than just like taking something to help you poop or not poop. And then you also, have the nerves in the lower back and sacrum, the tailbone region, that impact the ability for somebody to go to the bathroom. So in chiropractic, this is one I see all the time, especially in the pediatric world. Like, I don't take care of children, but I have a lot of chiropractors that specialize in pediatrics, and they have infants that suffer from either constipation or diarrhea. And they do very well if you're able to, and this is also transferable to adults. If you can do some mobilization or getting some pumping movement in the sacrum, the bottom of the spine, then that helps the person with the bowel movement.
Interesting. Well, this is a great segue to talking about body fluids, which is one of the main reasons that I think a lot of people are interested in your work. You're kind of known as the lymph guy. And lymph is not something that is spoken about very often at all in the health space. And I suspect it's something that should get a lot more attention. It's sort of like the underappreciated thing, you know, blood gets all of the fanfare. So for anyone who hasn't heard of lymph or doesn't really know what its role is in the body, could you give a rundown as to what it is and maybe some of the its key roles in the body?
Oh, that's like my favorite question you could ever ask. So I do love the lymph. I am called the lymph doc because I specialize in the lymphatic system and getting it moving and teaching people how to optimize its function. And you're right about the lymphatics. I mean, few people are aware of it. Even the ones that are aware of it, they look at it in this narrow category of why working it is beneficial. A lot of times it's maybe because they're trying to look a little bit younger and less puffy. So that's always a nice benefit. And the reason being for that is that you're decreasing inflammation and swelling in the body. So that always makes you feel better. Or maybe you have lymphedema, which is where lymphatics have damage to the valves and they're not able to adequately transport fluids. Now, very few people look at the lymphatic system in relationship to chronic pain and chronic inflammation and chronic disease. I do. One of the reasons is because I physiologically understand the connection. And that's what I teach. But I was that person who needed lymphatic work to recover from my own severe illness. Okay, so I was N equals one, ground zero patient for that. So it's funny, I always think about the lymphatics as the new fascia, because there used to be a time when nobody knew what fascia was. Or if they did, it was no big deal, and they just cut through it in surgery or disregarded it as any big thing. And then now we realize that was a big mistake. It's kind of everything. And I think people are doing realizing this now about lymph. They just thought the same thing. Well, it's just lymph. Yeah, but it's a massive thing. The reason it's important is two reasons. It's the primary component of your immune system, which is your ability to fight things off that are trying to kill you so you can stay strong and resilient and not die quick. So if you have I never get to use the word dysfunctional, like a maladapted, lymphatic system, you're going to be more prone to pain and inflammation and immune system disorder, dysregulation. It's also a primary part of your vascular system, your circulatory system, because the lymphatics directly connect to the vein system of the body. And the vein system of the body will directly connect to arterial systems of the body. So these fluids interconnect all over. And if you have a lymphatic system issue, you have a vascular flow issue where blood can't get to something well, or it can't get away from something well. And that primes up an environment for disease and inflammation. So the lymph is fascinating because you actually have more lymphatic fluid in the body than you do blood. You have about 5 liters of blood, and depending on your resource you look at, you got 10 to 12 liters. Some people put it higher of lymph. So if I look at those numbers, I automatically think the body must really think lymph is important because it gave me twice as much. And the reason being is this: The lymphatic system is the number one system to clean the inside of your body out. So all the fluid that your cells live in, all cells, I don't care what your eyeball or your foot cell or your bone cell, I don't care what you call it, they all around are surrounded by fluid. And that's called interstitial fluid. That fluid needs to stay clean. Mm-hmm. The lymphatic system does that. So it's the waste management system of your body. So it removes waste, but it also traps things in what's called lymph nodes. And that the lymph nodes are like barcode scanners in a grocery store for your body. Like if you want to scan an item, you know whether I'm getting broccoli or a Pop-Tart, right? And for your body, it scans it and tells your immune system, you have this or you have this. And then the body can respond appropriately, okay? And you have about 600 to 700 of those barcode scanners in the body, those mini toilets. So it removes metabolic waste, cellular waste in the body. So cells, when they create energy, they make waste. And that metabolic waste goes into that fluid and it has to get out, right? But it also transports nutrients too. It transports hormones. It transports fatty acids. It does, fat vitamins, fat soluble vitamins, transport those as well. Mm-hmm. So it's big to do with the fat transport system of the body. And if that's dysfunctional and it can't get rid of those things and transport those things, well, stuff that's not supposed to stay stuck inside of you now stays there. And because stuff stays trapped, the immune system turns on and is always on high alert because there's always stuff in you that's not supposed to be there. So then you get chronic underlying inflammation. And the chronic inflammation is the driver of chronic disease and autoimmune disease. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's why it's so important, because if that system becomes dysfunctional, it's pretty much physically and physiologically impossible for you to heal beyond a certain point. Because the capability of your body to do so, even though it's trying to do so, is limited.
Yeah.
And so if you can clear the lymph out and you get the waste out, then you also improve the blood flow to the different parts of the body that are waiting for the fresh, oxygenated, nutrient-rich blood to get there. And I'll tell you, listen, after 30 years, I know this much. No cell in your body is going to heal if it doesn't get the adequate blood flow it needs to do so. And if it's unable to eliminate the waste that surrounds the cell. That's it. I mean, it's a simple premise. And some people say it can't be that simple. I'm like, you want to bet? That's cell biology. That's all that is.
Yeah.
You have a single cell. Listen, everybody, you have trillions of cells in the body, and they're all different sizes and all different names, but they pretty much behave the same way. So you got a single, let's pick a single cell, and you're like, what does that cell need? Well, it needs nutrients and oxygen and amino acids. Like, that's kind of a big thing. And then you got the cell sitting there in the fluid. And then I asked this simple question. How does the nutrients and the oxygen from the food you're eating, the supplements you're taking, and all the breathing exercises you're doing physically get towards that cell? Your answer should be blood flow.
Yeah.
And if you don't get blood flow, that cell's dead, man. Mm. So it's got to get to the cell. And in order to get to the cell, guess what fluid it needs to cross to get there? The interstitial fluid.
Yeah.
But what if your interstitial fluid is full of waste? Because your lymphatic system is stuck. Well, then the nutrients can't get there. So you're basically stuck right there. And then the cell's like, well, what in the world do you want me to do, man? I can't do anything because I can't get anything, get rid of anything. So I'll give you the best I got. That's it. So this is where I come on in. And I'm like, well, how about you just free up the waste, clear, I call it muck, get the lymphatics moving. Because once you get the waste out, then the blood's ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can get this process again, so you can make a new cell and another one and another one and another one.
This might be a silly question, but you know, I presume that eventually the waste that is collected and taken through the lymph is eventually excreted through the urine, the filtrate of the blood.
Yes, correct. So whatever you trap stuff in the lymph nodes, the immune system comes out and you get like macrophages and all these things. They just eat stuff, right? And some cells are automatically programmed to die and engulf themselves anyway, called autophagy. And you have lysosomes in the cells that will be a big part of that. But every lymph node kills more of the stuff when it goes from node to node to node, and it traps things. So your lymphatic system, you're supposed to get really swollen in lymph nodes when you're sick, because that means they're doing their job.
Yeah.
But they're not supposed to stay swollen.
Mm.
Because sometimes what happens is that they stay swollen because stuff gets stuck in there that can't get out. So then it's just a repeat button, you know, replay button over and over and over. So it goes, you know, kill, 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 kill. And then whatever's left over will dump into the vein system at the collarbone, okay, in the subclavian vein. And then the vein flow will now take that back to the arterial flow, right? And then the arterial flow will deliver that to the organs so you can pee it out. So the majority of the waste from the lymphatics are going to go out and through pee.
Yeah.
So let me cycle back to the initial part of our conversation. What happens if you have kidneys that don't move a lot because you don't breathe well and you're in fight or flight? Well, your kidneys don't function as well, and you actually decrease blood flow to the kidneys, and your filtration rate of the kidneys goes down.
Yeah.
And then you'll get backflow into your body because the waste can't get out efficiently. Does that make sense? So
absolutely.
You're back to the breathing part, and then it'll still make its way through the vascular system, and the liver will cleanse some of that stuff as well. But breathing, why I love breathing so much is that it changes pressure in the abdomen, and then that pressure in the abdomen moves the lymph out of the abdomen back up towards the collarbone. And here's the fascinating thing. Your liver produces 50% of all the lymph in the entire body. And it dumps it right in the center of your abdomen in the largest lymphatic storage sac, transfer sac, called the cisterna chyli, right in the middle of your abdomen. And if you have a lot of tightness in there or poor breathing and tension in the abdomen or gut issues, that sac gets stagnated. And then the liver keeps trying to push stuff into that area, and it can't get in well. So then stuff goes back to the liver. And then the liver takes an extra burden.
So I presume that one of the big reasons people have a lot of problem with lymph and blood flow these days is primarily because of the modern lifestyle. We are too still. Not to mention the fact that we live indoors outside of the influence of light that, you know, I'm sure later we'll get to talking about how light plays a role in fluid dynamics in the body. But, you know, from your perspective, is lymph flow probably not going to be a problem for our hunter-gatherer ancestors because they're moving in a way that our human body is supposed to move? They're not sitting down in a chair with their, you know, knees at a 45-degree angle and, you know, slouching over a computer screen all day. Is that the general idea here?
Yes, I would agree with that 100% and a few other things too. So when you were a hunter-gatherer, I mean, you were on the move, right? So movement moves fluids. And it's the primary thing that actually moves the lymphatics and the vein flow of your body, particularly down below in the legs and at the calf. Yeah, that's why you want to walk and want to move, because it can push it back up towards the heart. They call the calf or gastroc soleus the second heart. Right? But if you sit and you slump, everything caves in on itself and you get excess tension big time in your belly and all the organs crunch against each other. And you're probably not breathing right if you're slumping. And so your diaphragm's not really moving that well. So you're stagnating there all the time. And not to mention that you're bending all the major joints of the body where the lymph node toilets reside. And the reason they reside there is because you're supposed to move those joints, not sit and bend them all day. So, like behind your knee, crease of your groin, the shoulder joint. When you slump over and sit, they all get like trapped. Now, the other thing that moves limp beyond movement is the breathing, the diaphragm breathing. So I'm pretty sure hunter-gatherers most likely had better breathing patterns than we did, but you don't know that for sure. Another thing is they didn't have the absolute horror of nutrition that we have in the world today with processed foods and toxins and you know, all the different things sprayed on food that has to work with. So that is an issue, overburdening of your liver. But another one is just incessant human being chronic stress of living in the modern world today. You know, back then, I mean, that was some high stress because you had to not get eaten by other things. But you also had a support community around you that you knew had your back. You don't necessarily have that so much anymore in the world today, honestly, because people are just so detached and removed from each other. They're very lucky if they have a group of people that they can really depend on. And then they're just stuck looking at a damn phone all day. So they're slumped over and they're all alone. And the thing about sympathetic dominance, or when you have that stress, that high stress increases the sympathetic nervous system. And the sympathetic nervous system decreases fluid flow. It will slow down your lymphatic pipes. All right. And if you stay that way, it actually damages the pipes and things flow backwards. So you've got a couple of things that of why back then lymphatic systems likely functioned a lot better. And you know, nobody had to told them to, you know, work with your lymphatic system. They just did it. But we are, by moving and breathing and nutrition and sunlight and hydration, I mean, stuff. Honestly, if you look at anything in the world today and people say, how can you get healthy? They're going to tell you everything I just told you right there. It's all going to come down to the same. They're like, oh man, I've heard this 1,000 times, man. Don't you have anything new? No, because you don't need anything new. You just need to consistently do the basics that you already know about. You're just not doing it.
Talking about, you know, getting to do lymphatic movement or you know, there are many things that can be done that you've really been a spearhead in to help unstagnate this lymphatic flow. And, you know, it's actually quite gentle. You know, you don't have to be too crazy with it, but maybe you can just sort of let me know some of the easiest ways and some of the key places, like around the sternum, that can be worked on a daily basis. I know there are a lot of people out there who do the things that you recommend, and anecdotally, disproportionately incredible results just by getting the lymph moving on a regular basis. So you know, how can you know, how can, like myself, I'd love to know what the best things to do for lymphatic flow are.
Yeah. Here's the cool thing, man. I'll answer that, but I'm gonna segue into it, mm-hmm. if I may. I was taking a course in neurology once, and a guy said, he said, listen, you're all practicing neurology, you're just doing it by accident. Which means that everything you do influences your nervous system no matter what it is.
Yeah.
You just don't have any rhyme or reason to what you're doing, right? And I thought, brilliant, because that's the same thing with lymphatics. Everything you do influences the lymphatic system. So you're already moving your lymph, right? But there's ways that you can move it more efficiently or better mm-hmm. than you are doing now. So I just teach people to move lymphatics with purpose, with intention and attention. And this is why people ask me, why do we even need lymphatic work? I get massages all the time. Right? Because when you get a massage, it's moving lymph, trust me.
Yeah.
And it's moving blood flow. But what happens is you're just rubbing stuff wherever you want when you're rubbing it, and you're sending fluids just all over the place.
Right.
There's no what I call hydrodynamics, physics of understanding how fluids move in the body based on pressure. A massage and exercise is basically taking a giant snow globe and just shaking it up.
Yeah.
Stuff just moves around. But that doesn't mean it's going to move through efficiently when there's blocks in certain places. So people say, Doc, do you like vibration plates and rebounders and trampolines? Are they good for lymph? Yeah, they're awesome. Right? But if you do some of the stuff that I'm going to show you here before you do that, you'll actually have a much better result, because you're now learning and understanding the physics of biofluid movement in the body.
Yeah.
And once I explain that, it helps people understand why they may have been hitting these like plateaus or barriers on their therapies, because they've been trying so many things, but then they can't move beyond it. And the reason being is that you're just at the limit of your physiology at that moment. Okay. So let's talk about some of the places that you can look. And I do teach this in my Big Six lymphatic reset, which is the technique, it's the self-care that I have been teaching for over a decade, that you can find on my YouTube channel. You very well may link it here, I'm not sure, but it's not difficult to find. You just type in BIG, the number 6, and Perry. It'll show up somewhere, and just do that. But that whole thing is based on how fluids flow. And what's different about our work is that everybody tells you to start rubbing your lymph like from the feet up. Wrong. Don't do that. Okay. You have to start from where the lowest pressure in your body is for lymphatic fluid flow. Okay. The reason you want to start there is because everything is trying to flow to that point, because it's the lowest pressure in the body. Mm-hmm. So the high pressure everywhere else, from the swelling and the inflammation and the pain, that's where it's trying to go. And that's the collarbone. So the number one place that I would tell anybody who's listening and watching your podcast today is spend a lot of time massaging and rubbing and opening and moving the collarbone region above it and below it, like a lot. Because if you have a lot of excess tension there because of, let's go back to your breathing. If you're over breathing from your chest and the shoulders and your mouth open and your neck, you're causing a lot of tension for about 20 some thousand breaths a day here that gets tension. And when you have excess tension and tightness here, you decrease how well fluids can move because there's too much tightness. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
They can't flow well through high tension points. So if you have increased tension here, then you're increasing pressure here, which decreases lymphatic flow because the pressure's too high. And it just goes back out, which is why you still stay swollen or puffy.
Yep.
So the first thing I look for when anybody, when I see them, is puffiness above either collarbone. If you have obvious puffiness above the collarbone, that means you've had a long-standing lymphatic issue and blood flow issue for quite a long time. Right. That is a major sign that you have inflammation throughout the whole body and you need to get lymphatic work like immediately, okay? So you rub in that, what we call the thoracic inlet slash outlet, which is the, to me, most important anatomical place in the body because it will control blood flow to and from the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just open up there, then everything else automatically starts to move a little bit better, saying, holy cow, Dr. Perry finally opened up the collarbone. This is great. Then if you can get your diaphragm breathing down, and then you get the pressure increasing and decreasing in the abdomen, then that'll act like a kind of like a siphoning suction effect, pulling, because it's actually not so much a flow to the collarbone, it's a pull towards the collarbone. It's like a suction effect that happens through that diaphragmatic breathing that will open it up. And the other places that I tell people to focus is really big time in the abdomen, a lot of the abdomen. That's because of, we told before about the lymphatics, and a lot of people have inflammation in the abdomen just because of the modern world. Those two spots right here are really, really big. And the other components of my big six, it's just the six primary places in the body where most of those lymph node toilets reside, which are the joints, the big joints.
Yeah.
The shoulder joint, you know, because you're supposed to move your shoulders over your head, you know. People very rarely do that. It's usually down and folded forward looking at a phone for too long.
Mm.
So you trap that off. And the other one is the crease of the groin that's really tight because of sitting. And then behind the knee because of sitting. So when you trap all those joints down, you don't stand a chance of having good blood flow in the hands or the feet or the back or the head or anything else. So those are primary fluid flow choke points in the body. And I'd like to say one thing more. One of the phrases that I teach people is that no system in the body ever works alone.
Mm.
So your lymphatic system doesn't function by itself. It works with the other systems. So in each one of those areas that I just told you to open up for flow, those are major areas where blood flow gets restricted at the same time.
Mm.
And then those blood flow routes and those lymph flow routes, I'll give you one guess what they run right beside. the nerves.
Mm.
And so the nerves will get a lot of irritation around them when those things don't flow well. And when nerves get irritated, you know how do you know when a nerve is irritated, what you get? Pain.
Yeah.
Pain. So that's why people feel so much better when they do this, is because I'm not teaching you to isolate moving fluid around what area hurts. Like, so let's take an example. Let's say your right knee hurts, and you would start treating your right knee, which is a logical step.
Yeah.
Okay? But if your right knee doesn't get better after 3 months, I'm going to tell you it's not a knee problem.
Right.
Okay. It's chronic. But everybody tries to increase and change the nerves and the fluid flow around the knee, but that's not enough. You have to open up all the other areas, because if you have restriction in these other areas, it affects the flow to the knee. And that's where modern medicine is really falling behind, because they're extremely myopic and reductionistic in treating something, which has its place for sure. Mm. Especially in traumatic care. Like, you wouldn't come to see me if you have your knee torn off in an accident. You need to get trauma care and put your knee together so you don't die. Well, you better see me afterwards.
Yeah.
So that's that role. But it's vastly different than somebody who says, "Doc, my knee has been hurting for 3 months, and I don't understand why. I didn't fall. I didn't know that happened." You can't have the same treatment process. You can't have the same clinical reasoning process. Not the same thing at all. And that's when you have to look at everything else. And then here's the kicker, man. Let's say you did have a trauma to your knee. Right? How well you're going to recover from the trauma is going to depend on what was the state of your lymphatic system and nervous system and vascular system before you tore your knee. Because if you were an individual that was really high stressed, poor diet, stagnation, hardly moved, you're probably going to be the one that might have chronic pain after the surgery and doesn't respond to rehab, or takes 3 times as long to get better, as opposed to the person who did eat well before, didn't have a ton of stress, been doing my big six for a while, knows about breathing. Most likely, they're the person who's going to recover faster and better from the procedure. The reason being is it was two different knees. Because medicine will treat the body part that's hurt.
Mm.
I need to help the person that's attached to the knee. That's the difference. And that's also why we are really struggling in the world today with an increase in chronic inflammation, chronic disease, autoimmune disease, chronic pain, because you can't treat those like you do trauma care. There's no single shot you can get for it. There's no magic pill you can take for it. There's no magic supplement or magic diet. It's a culmination of a lot of different things. That's called systems biology. That's the whole body having a say in how part individual areas heal. I'm going to rest now.
Very interested in the fact that there's a lot of parallels between what you speak about with the flows of the fluids of the body and traditional Chinese medicine, for instance, talking about stagnation.
There is.
And it seems to me as though, you know, the way you're looking at lymph is basically, rediscovering in a sense, maybe in a different way, what was known back in Eastern medicine. And the parallels are quite startling in that, you know, acupuncture can treat chronic pain quite well, as can, you know, alleviating the stagnation of lymph and blood flow as well. So it seems like this is just a different way of viewing the things that were seen in Eastern medicine, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah, that's interesting you said that, because I've studied many different disciplines and approaches to healing, a lot in Eastern medicine. So mm-hmm. thank you for noticing some of the carryover. A lot in Ayurvedic medicine.
Yep.
And they talk about lymphatics a ton in Ayurvedic medicine.
Right.
Classical osteopathic medicine, not modern, classical, from Andrew Taylor Still. He was one of the first people to talk about the value of lymphatic flow and blood flow. To him, they're two of the most important things. That's probably been the biggest influence in my work, yep. honestly. Yep. But you remember how I said everybody who has these different disciplines, they're trying to accomplish the same thing yep. for people? They're also using different language to explain the same things.
Yes.
It's just your paradigm determines the language that you're using. So let me give you an example. In Eastern medicine, they talk about stagnation a lot, right? And then, and especially in Eastern medicine, big time stagnation with the veins. They'll look at vein stagnation a ton, yep. which is a big, big part of my work too. And that ties into lymphatic stagnation. And physiologically, from a Western medicine perspective, you have twice as many veins as you do arteries. That's because veins are supposed to be the reservoir of backflow when there's a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got the chi or the energy. Well, to me, that travels along vascular and fluid flow lines. So to me, chi would be blood flow. And they actually, I think, say that too. It's more mm-hmm. of an energetic blood flow thing, that's energy. And you see a big correlation between meridian systems and fascial line connections mm-hmm. and fluid flow dimensions. So this is where it's been very helpful for me, because I can help a Western medicine practitioner understand what I'm saying. So I wouldn't be saying, okay, I'm going to follow the meridian chi line up from here to there. What I'm going to say is I'm going to follow the anatomical, physiological line of the popliteal lymph node to the inguinal lymph node and coming down the saphenous vein and the femoral nerve to open up that channel. And they go, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the same thing. It's just that I'm phrasing it to where they're not looking at it of like, this guy's off his cracker. Like, you know, or it's woo-woo.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, because it's all based on the anatomy and physiology and physics. So that's why I really hate it when I kind of see the different disciplines, you know, going at it or attacking each other, because one, it's not about you. You're doing this to help someone else.
Yeah.
I'm doing this to help someone who's suffering. And listen, I'll be honest with you. The person who's suffering doesn't care if you call it a meridian line or a chi line or a fascial line or a lymph node. They don't care. They just want to know, can you help me with the way you're looking and treating the body, yes or no? So you have to take your ego out of the game and remember who you're doing this for.
Yep. One of the, I mean, the main constituent of both blood and lymph is water. And, you know, yeah. I mentioned before, yeah. You know, our mutual podcast guest, Jerry Pollack, has really
He's
changed
awesome.
The way we think about the way these fluids flow through the body. And it makes you also think about hydration. Hydration is a bit of a tricky topic, I guess. You know, a lot seems to get lost in translation.
It doesn't have to be, but it is, yeah.
A lot seems to get lost in translation, and I feel like there are perhaps better ways to discuss what true hydration is and how we can have our fascia not, you know, depleted of fluid and not, you know, tight, and our body being fully hydrated. So what's your approach to helping people make sure that they're adequately hydrated? And that obviously that's not just drinking heaps of water.
Right. Yeah, this is a huge thing. I'm so glad you brought this up, because the majority of the body is water. But like your lymphatics, depending on the resources, 95 to 96% water.
Yep.
Your cerebrospinal fluid, your brain fluid, and the fluid around your spinal cord, 99.9% water. Blood is like 70% water. So if you're dehydrated, automatically, how well do you think all of those things are going to work?
Yeah.
Your body's going to try to make it work as best it can, but that's a big strain, man. That's a lot. And eventually it's just going to let you know, I've had it, and it's going to hurt you, right? So hydration is huge. I tell people this all the time. You can do my lymphatic work every single day, but if you're dehydrated, it ain't going to work.
Yeah.
You're not going to get well if you're dehydrated. I don't care what magical program you did or how many double-blind studies you got to prove that this helps you. That's a non-negotiable. And that's why the light and the sunlight is so powerful, because that's going to make a difference on your hydration for yourself as well, and how it interacts with water and the fourth phase of water and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, people overcomplicate water too. But the first thing I'd do is just see where people are in their hydration game. I just ask them, are you drinking water? And if they say yes, I don't just leave it there. I have to ask, how much? Well, then that throws them off, because it's like, you know, maybe a shot glass, right? And then you have to ask, well, what type of water, right? So the first thing that I do is just see where they are. And I try to get them to drink more water and less of everything else.
Yeah.
In the beginning. Like peel back your coffee and your beer and your juices and your power drinks and stuff like that, because that's also going to offset the water when you drink it. And try to do just some easy wins, man. Like, I don't have to send you out for a $10,000 filtration system and drive you bananas on, I'm drinking the wrong thing, so my body's going to explode, right? Just try not to drink out of plastic. Try drinking out of glass. That's a big win right there. And then begin to research getting yourself some better quality water resources, which is not always easy for people of you. And then looking into the electrolytes, cell salts, minerals, things like that. And of course, Gerald Pollack will talk about your, you know, structured water, fourth phase of water type thing in relationship to light and red light and stuff like that. But what I found is that you can overwhelm somebody with just so many different things that they need to start changing in their life that it immobilizes them and they don't change. Just give them easy things, because you have to look at this stuff as, There's no destination for health. It's a journey. Mm. It's a direction, not an endpoint. Right? So if you can't find a way to incorporate it into your life for the long run, it's going to be hard to stay with the consistency of the basics and the fundamentals. I've had people that one of the reasons that they've had chronic pain and headaches and depression and tightness and stiffness and all sorts of issues is fundamentally they just were dehydrated. But they weren't taking in enough good quality water, and they weren't getting themselves out into this thing called sunlight. that's my ground-based starting position with water, is just making people more aware of its importance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've read some work, particularly a book called Bioenergetics by Alexander Lowen, who looked at how the way the body was moving could help with people doing trauma work. And basically the thesis is that body work can help people get through traumatic experiences and basically recontextualize them and move on from them. And that speaks to this whole, you know, mind-body connection as well. And I'm wondering if throughout your career you've done body work with people and you've sort of reinstated some sense of balance, and then their mindset or their thinking changes once their structure has been sort of more reestablished. Is that something you see in your practice?
Yeah, for sure. One, because you get the unbelievable power of a hands-on therapeutic treatment. Mm. Hand on another human being with touch is amazingly powerful, energetically wise and healing wise. Sometimes that's all the body's been wanting, honestly. The type of touch, too. It needs to, you can tell an empathetic touch when you get it. And someone who has a lot of experience on working with not just the tissues. I'm not talking about touching tissues. I'm not really trying to influence the tissues. I'm trying to connect to the human being and the energy and the story of this person who has the tissues. And that's why a very skilled practitioner with the hands, which is what I do. So I firmly believe you cannot give a complete and accurate diagnosis and assessment on a person if you have not done a hands-on assessment. And few people know how to do a good one, and it's a lost science and art, big time. Because I can put my hand on an area, get a sense of the area, but I can read the reaction of the entire body on the person from where I have my hand and see what changes. And that's why this stuff is very elusive and hard to find. I have a saying that I use and often when I teach is that, see, my thing is called chasing pain. So we treat pain, but I don't chase, you know, where it's going like in a pinball machine, okay? I go after the pain that you don't know about to help the pain that won't leave you alone. So what that means is you already know the one that won't leave you alone because that's all you've been thinking about, and then that's where you point to when you come in to see me. Mm-hmm. That's not hard to find, man. I mean, anybody can start there, and you should. I'm looking for another part on you that's probably going to hurt as much when I touch it, or your nervous system is holding a lot there. Mm-hmm. You just don't know what's holding it there. But you'll know it when I touch it. So let me give you an example. People that come and see me for issues in the lower back or the shoulders or the neck. I mean, you pick a body part. So I start to go after areas on the body that very few people have actually put their fingers there because they're like, what are you going here for? That's not near my painful body part. And two places always stand out the most. One is the sternum bone, the center of the sternum.
Interesting.
As an area that anatomically, ton of bound fascia there, a lot. Okay. Anatomically in this region too, It's very prone to puffiness and swelling and edema when you have deep blocks in the lymphatics along the spine.
Right.
But you won't feel pain here until I touch it. And that's an area where many people have a visceral withdrawal emotional reaction of, they go, like, it startles them.
Yeah.
And many people will actually just out of nowhere start to cry when I touch there. Why are you having that response to that? If you have that kind of response to that, that's how much of your nervous system and your neurology is tied up in this region, right? But here's the point. You didn't know that. You didn't know that. But here's where I want to bring you into the matrix. You did know it.
Mm.
It's just you knew it deep in here, in the subconscious, in the part that's always trying to heal you. So you don't have to think about this stuff. You can just go on with your life. And you've been focusing on this shoulder part, for instance, if I was seeing shoulder, you've been focusing on this, but your nervous system has to deal with this center part too. It's been dealing with this too.
Yeah.
And the second biggest place is the center of the abdomen. Center of the abdomen. Close third is your navel. Close third is your navel. And the reason the abdomen is so much like that is that's because of the, anybody ever heard of that gut-brain axis, emotional brain, enteric nervous system?
Yep.
I feel like when something painful happens to you, you feel like you just got kicked in the guts, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you hold all that stuff. And then I'll touch that, and then I can kind of get the same reaction. I'll give you a cool thing that I've learned over the years is a great, neurological tell of the body to show you this is a big place you need to be working on, if you want me to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So always watch the feet. So whenever you go around an area, let's say I touch up around your left jaw, just very lightly, coming around near the left jaw and put a little pressure on your left jaw. And I see your feet start to move. Like you shake your foot, you extend your toes, you curl your toes, any one of them. If you see the feet move at any time that you touch a body part, that is a major place you need to be looking for something. And the reason it's so powerful is because the person doesn't even know they're doing it.
Yeah.
That's the tell. That's the tell. And I guarantee you, I'll stand by it until I'm dead. You'll find something there that's a piece of the puzzle.
As someone who would like to pursue some sort of body work in their career, I'm very grateful you shared that with me because I think that's a really brilliant tip to have when you're trying to understand something about someone that they don't consciously understand themselves. And I just want to reiterate how grateful I am that you spoke about touch. I think touch is one of the most important things. And I think really one of the things I tell almost everyone who I've worked with is either go and get a massage or have your significant other, massage you. They don't have to be great at it. Just the fact that they're putting their hands on you, on your skin, is doing something that you can't get from anywhere else. And I think that's such a great way to sort of tie up this conversation is, like you said, getting back to the things that matter most. And I think touch is one of those things. And I think it's why body working practitioners like yourself are so important today. More than ever, is because they can do things that other practitioners can't. I've learned a lot speaking with you.
Thank you. Yeah, the one thing that I love about touch is that there's something. I have many people that come in to see me who they can't find anything on a blood test,
mm.
They can't find anything on the MRI or the ultrasound or whatever, but they're really in a bad place. The only way you're going to find it is by your hands, because there's things that you will find by hand and touch that you'll never be able to find from a medical test ever, because they just won't show up. But you'll find it then, right? And that's the biggest missing piece in healthcare today. One is because they don't get enough training in it. But two, the broken system doesn't allow them to spend the time with someone to do it, even if they wanted to. They got 5 minutes with somebody, you know?
Oh, well, I think that's why I'm so grateful for the work that you've been doing. Again, you know, one of the really early adopters to podcasting. I can't imagine how much information you've shared, and it certainly helped me along my journey as well. So I really can't thank you enough for sharing so much information for free as well. Your YouTube channel, your Instagram, their wealth of information that people should definitely check out. Now, I will link them below so people can learn more about lymphatic flow and blood flow. There's some incredible videos on your Instagram that I have them all saved, you know, so I can do these type of practices on myself as well. So thank you again. I won't take any more of your time, but I just really appreciate what you've been doing. Yeah, basically for as long as I've been alive.
Well, thank you very much. I really had a wonderful time. I can't believe it went by so fast. So I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed the conversation. I've left links to all of Perry's work below. His Instagram and YouTube are fantastic resources. I've also left all of my links in the episode notes, so please feel free to subscribe and engage, as there will be much more content like this to come. Again, if you'd like to support my work, please consider subscribing to my Substack, as it is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go beyond this podcast. Additionally, a solo episode expanding on our conversation is also available if you'd like even more nuance. This support really helps me keep this going. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.